Hello, welcome to another episode of Spellbound. I am your host, Julian Smith. It's great to have you with us. We got a great episode for you. Today, we're talking about artificial intelligence in the workplace with New York Times bestselling author Martin Ford. Martin, your book is Rise of the Robots: Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future. It's an amazing read. I'm really enjoying it. Thanks for being on the show today.
Sure, great.
Your book is a New York Times bestseller. It was Financial Times McKinsey Business Book of the Year, and it has been translated into 20 different languages. You must have made your family very proud with that mouthful.
Yeah, it's been a good experience.
So let's talk about your book, Rise of the Robots. It's about technology's effect on the workplace and the economy. And it's no surprise that there have been a lot of jobs disappearing in America. And, you know, there's like a certain amount of jobs that needs to be created each year to keep up with the population growth. And we just simply haven't been doing it. So there's just been a lot of unemployed people. And usually the argument is, we're manufacturing too many things in China, or the American economy is just in the toilet, and that's why there's no jobs being created, that's why we're so behind. But your book is all about how that's wrong, and how it's more to do with the fact that automation is so heavily ingrained into the workplace now that it's literally replacing jobs that humans used to do. And the things that it is learning to do is getting more and more sophisticated. And it's kind of like a wake-up call for us to just kind of start addressing some of these issues before they get out of hand.
Well, you know, technology overall is undoubtedly, unquestionably a positive force. I mean, you know, I don't think anyone should be against technology. You can ask yourself, I mean, look at an average person today. An average person in an advanced country today is much better off in almost every way than a very, very wealthy person 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's all because of the advance of technology. So the last thing that I would advocate on any level and from any perspective is, let's stop this. You know, let's regulate the hell out of this or prevent all of this progress because it's going to have a bad impact. I'm just saying we need to recognize that we're probably reaching kind of a tipping point where the disruption that's going to be wrought by technology, in particular the impact on the job market, is going to be maybe unprecedented. It's going to be unlike anything we've ever seen before.
And when you and I talk about automation, we're not just, you know, talking about giant robots building boxes for Amazon. You know, it can be it's something as simple as an email or a tweet. The fact that you don't need to hire a human to send that message for you anymore. And, you know, we take this for granted, but this is a huge deal. These are jobs that humans would have been hired for in the past, and now we're not hiring those positions anymore. And, you know, it's the scope of this is only increasing. But what I love about your perspective is you're a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, and so you're using all this technology, but you're aware of the pitfalls, and you've got a sense of moral obligation, obviously. And so what do you think we should be doing? You think we're fine? You think we're on the right track? You think we should stop once and for all?
That doesn't mean we should stop it. It means that we should have an open mind about what we're going to have to do to adapt to that so that we can make sure that we leverage all of this progress on behalf of everyone in our society and don't just follow kind of the default path, which is, I'm afraid, going to end up being that a few people at the very top, you know, the top of the income distribution, end up much better off, but then everyone else is sort of in many ways left behind. And we don't want that to happen.
So you've got the businesses, the financial elite, the people with all the money at the top, you know, they're going to have a lot of responsibility and they're going to be a big variable as this all plays out. But what can everyday people be doing about this? Is there anything everyday people can be doing?
Well, I think everyone, you know, has got a vested interest in this and everyone has got the potential to make a difference. I mean, a big part of it is just starting a conversation about this. I mean, there are things you can do as an individual to try to remain relevant as all of this unfolds. But beyond that, it's important that we have a public conversation about this. Eventually, this is an issue that needs to be dragged into the political arena. And that's starting to happen to some extent, not extensively, but it's getting going. And I think that in the future, it will become a much bigger deal. And, you know, people have got to do what they can to make sure that everyone becomes aware of this and it becomes part of our discourse, I think.
So how do you think this is all going to play out? You think we're going to start seeing regulations on how much automation can be used in the workplace?
Well, I'm sure that there will be, you know, companies and people on both sides of this. I mean, in Silicon Valley, if you look at the major tech companies, there's definitely a building awareness. You may have heard Mark Zuckerberg, for example, talking about a basic income, which is one of the solutions that I've advocated.
A universal
basic income, meaning everyone would receive a minimal basic income, whether right. they're working or not. That's one of the most prominent possible solutions to this problem. Maybe we can talk a bit more about that later. But I mean, to answer your question, of course, there will be other more conservative voices too that will want to just dampen down any talk of any kind of redistribution or anything as a solution to this. So there's going to be a political division and debate over that, just as there is with an issue like climate change. Yep. And that's something that we're going to have to acknowledge and ultimately deal with. But I do think that this is an issue that is coming to the forefront gradually. I mean, it's getting a lot more visibility. The other important point I would make is that, you know, everyone at every level of our society, even the most wealthy people, have got a vested interest in this. And the reason is that the economy has got to have consumers, right? I mean, if we really get into a situation in the future where a lot of jobs disappear, of course, that means that people don't have incomes. They don't have money to spend. That means that they can't be consumers. They can't contribute to creating demand in the economy. They can't buy the products and services that are being produced. And that ultimately could result in a real problem.
So what you just said there was really important. And I want to make sure that people caught it because there's a pretty wide audience here. You said that if people don't have money, if people aren't making money because they're not working, because robots are doing all the work, if they don't have money, they can't buy stuff. And buying stuff is what drives the economy. It's what makes the whole machine work. People get money and then they spend it. They put it back into the system. They put it back into circulation. And that's what makes the machine go round. But that is beginning to happen less and less now.
There's also the potential for financial problems or a financial crisis. I mean, if we think back to just 2008, when we had this massive financial crisis, the way that started was with the so-called subprime meltdown, which happened because a lot of people did not have enough income to pay their mortgages, right? We can imagine something like that unfolding again if we get into a situation with high unemployment or where wages are driven down to very low levels. So even, you know, and once something like that starts, then even the people at the top are impacted. So I think everyone has got a vested interest in addressing this issue and coming up with viable solutions.
What are the people going to do if they can't afford a smartphone or they can't afford the next new iPhone? They're going to lose their minds.
Right. Well, it's going to be a bigger deal if they can't afford to pay their rent, right? That, you know, and they can't afford food and things like that.
They might be more upset about the smartphones.
You know, if you live, as I do, near San Francisco, you already see so many people that are homeless, living on the street, literally.
Right.
This is a problem that could get worse if we don't adjust to this in the appropriate way.
It's kind of ironic, really, when you think about it. I mean, the whole point of automation is doing things better and faster than people can. So, of course, it was going to come to this, but we can't turn back. You know, we shouldn't turn back. We should try to embrace this for the greater good of everyone. And, you know, with each new technological breakthrough, we're doing the impossible.
Of course. I mean, that's been the whole history of technology, is that machines have helped us to do things better and faster and more efficiently. And they've helped us to do things that would have been impossible without that technology. But here's what I think is really different this time, that really stands out, is that the machines are beginning in a limited way to really substitute for human brain power. So it's not just about displacing muscle power or manual things or extending the capabilities of human brains. I mean, at least relative to some people, these technologies are really going to substitute for basically everything that they're capable of doing.
Right. You're saying that robots were only capable for a while of doing very basic things, but now they're starting to do more difficult things. And we never thought we were going to see them doing the things that they're doing.
One of the realities of the job market is that quite a few people, probably more than half of people, come to work and they do jobs that are fundamentally routine and repetitive and predictable. And what that means is basically they do the same kind of stuff again and again, not repetitive, like literally standing there doing exactly the same thing like on an assembly line, but they do face the same challenges again and again. And we are seeing this emerging technology called, you know, machine learning, which is basically all about having algorithms course through data and then analyze that data and then learn from that. And that means that a lot of these more routine, predictable jobs, the nature of that job is essentially going to be encapsulated in the data in a way that a machine will be able to come along and eventually do that whole job, or at least many of the tasks within that job. And I think it's probably inevitable that that means a lot of work is going to evaporate. So there are going to be a lot fewer jobs that are routine and repetitive in nature out there for people to, you know, to take. And that's a big problem because, you know, a big part of our population relies on that kind of work. And while we can certainly talk about educating people and so forth, we can't take everyone that's best equipped to do, you know, something that's relatively routine and predictable and turn that person into, you know, a robotics engineer or a rocket scientist or Einstein. That's not realistic. I mean, some, you know, people have different levels of capability and so forth. And also it's not clear that even if we could do that, there would be enough of those jobs anyway. So
right.
This is probably a big problem we're going to have to face. And this is why I think we need to really talk about some out of the box solutions. And one of those is the idea of providing everyone with a guaranteed universal basic income so that even if people can't find a job, they've at least got some minimal level of income that allows them to survive economically and not, you know, be homeless on the street, and also gives them some income that they can go out and spend so that they can participate in really driving the economy. And that is an idea that it is really beginning to gain traction. In Silicon Valley, quite a few people are talking about it. Throughout the world in different countries like Finland, for example, like in Netherlands, the governments there are experimenting with it, at least on small scales. So it's an idea that I think is going to be very, very important for the future. And it's definitely going to require a shift in our values and the way we look at things. But I think that my personal view is it's almost inevitable that a day will come at some point in the future when it's understood that everyone in our society is inherently titled to at least a minimal income.
It is admittedly scary when you first hear it. At least to me it was. But the truth remains, we're not self-sufficient like we used to be. And this isn't a new problem. Robots and computers have been doing a lot of work for us for a long time. But the problem is, in the future, when they're doing all of the work or most of the work, how are we going to be making money and what's going to drive our economy?
Yeah, I agree too. And you're right. It's a transition that's been going on for, you know, generations now. Even way back in the 1930s, Friedrich Hayek, who is a very, you know, conservative, iconic economist that is revered by conservative people, not a lefty at all, was an advocate of a basic income or a guaranteed minimum income. And basically that was his rationale. The society was changing. I mean, it used to be people lived on farms, right? They could grow their own food. They were self-sufficient. Generations lived together. You know, the grandparents lived with the family and they all lived together in a big house. And all of that was changing rapidly during that time. And of course, it's continued to change. And now people can't grow their own food anymore, right? They're not self-sufficient in that way. And so you need to...
And the environment's bad.
Yeah, and you need to change our social model in a way that really adapts to that. And I think, you know, a guaranteed minimum income is a great way to do that.
One thing that blows me away is just how, you know, the definition of repetition keeps changing because these machines are just learning at such a rapid rate. And, you know, right now it's just the working class jobs that are being threatened. But in the next few years, we're going to see higher and higher level jobs going away. And do you think there's a limit to that? Do you think there are any jobs that are safe, like creative jobs or, you know, like doctors or anything like that?
No, I would never say that there's a ceiling at all. So, you know, once you go far enough out in the future, all bets are off. Everything is on the table. I would say that for the foreseeable future, meaning the next decade or two, you're right. The areas that are safest from automation, I think, for the foreseeable future are first creativity, if you're really coming up with genuinely new ideas. If you're an artist, an architect, an engineer, a scientist, someone who's really coming up with new ideas out of the box. The second area are things that really involve deep, sophisticated relationships with other people. And that might be forms of empathy, for example, if you're a counselor, a psychologist, a nurse, you know, a lot of healthcare related type things. Or it could be in the business world where you're really building sophisticated relationships with clients and you really need to get inside their mind and understand you know, their needs and their, you know, in order to serve their interests and so forth, that those kinds of jobs are going to be relatively safe. And the third area are things that really require lots of mobility and dexterity in unpredictable environments. And this would be things like skilled trade jobs, electricians, plumbers. I mean, you know, think about the electrician crawling underneath the house to deal with the wires, or the plumber dealing with the rusty pipes and all of this stuff. You know, a robot is, we're not going to build a robot that can do that in the foreseeable future. That's still science fiction. Same thing would be true, for example, a nurse in a hospital running around, dealing with patients, all kinds of things at a very rapid rate, all kinds of unpredictable environments, both in terms of dexterity, problem solving, relationships with clients or with patients. I mean, you know, a robot's not going to do that anytime soon. So those are all jobs that are pretty safe. But I you know, in each of these areas, there is work being done to solve these problems. I mean, you know, in my book, I give examples of creative algorithms that are already, for example, writing symphonies and doing electronic design and painting original works of art. I mean, you know, so there already are creative algorithms out there. And this is something that is going to get better and better. So, you know, once we get out beyond 20 years or so, I mean, I don't know what's going to be safe anymore. It is conceivable that at some point, certainly if we have true human level artificial intelligence, if that really happens, then you can imagine a world where machines are better at virtually everything, even jobs that you would consider to be purely artistic, things like being an actor or an actress. You know, you can imagine that virtual characters that are intelligent would be able to outperform humans even in those areas. So, you know, nothing is off the table, but I, you know, that's sort of the best advice we can give for the foreseeable future.
It's funny, you talked about algorithms and how smart they're getting. And, you know, there was a time in YouTube's infancy when the videos on the homepage were curated by a human. They were hand selected. They made a change. I can't remember what year it was, probably 2011. They shifted to a content curation algorithm. And it's crazy how intelligent that thing has become. It'll gauge an entire video and make notes of where people are rewinding and skipping and turning off the video. And it, you know, they've generated this, this perfect framework for how to release content on their platform. And they know exactly what will work. They can tell you almost mathematically what will work if you do it. And it's crazy how accurate it's become.
Sure. That's you know, probably one of the most important and obvious applications of artificial intelligence or machine learning that we've really seen. And it's YouTube, it's Amazon, it's Netflix, it's you know, dating sites. They're using this technology to match you with things that interest you or that you'll find compelling, whether it's people or content or whatever. And that's one of the areas where we've seen the first emergence of this. And, you know, that's going to continue, and we'll see these technologies applied to many, many other areas. But I think what you say is true, that this is evidence that these are just incredibly powerful technologies that can do things that no human being would ever be able to do, right? I mean, YouTube would never be able to employ people that would be able to provide the same level of service there. And, you know, so artificial intelligence is going to provide us with many advantages and good things that are really beyond anything that would have been conceivable, you know, without that technology.
Most people, when they think of Google, a company like Google or Facebook, they think, oh, these are these huge entities, and they are. But it's really fascinating when you start to think how small those companies are in comparison to other companies. You know, you've compared the size of Google, the amount of employees they hire, to, I can't remember the numbers, but they're staggering. It's, I mean, you might know, do you know some of them off the top of your head?
Yeah. I mean, if you compare Google now to General Motors, say, when it was at its peak employment back in the late 1970s, Google employs about 5% of the number of people that General Motors did. I mean, you know, General Motors employed almost 1 million people. Google, I mean, it's, you know, I don't know how many it is now, but in 2012, it was about 40,000, I think.
Relatively small company.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's just a tiny number. I mean, in terms of the number of people that they really employ relative to their revenues. And of course, they're also a very elite group of people. You know, Google doesn't create a lot of jobs for average people, typical people that, you know, it creates a lot of jobs for people that went to MIT or Stanford and got, graduate degrees in computer science, but not, you know, fewer for, you know, average people. And that's very different from what General Motors or other companies did. So we are seeing that these corporations that are emerging in these new areas are becoming a lot less labor intensive. So there are going to be less traditional jobs there, you know, for people. And I think that's part of the trend that we're seeing toward a general lack of jobs. But more importantly, at least in the near term, a lack of good jobs. I mean, you know, it's not, if you look at the unemployment rate in the United States now, it's not actually high. But what we are seeing is that job creation has been weighted pretty heavily toward these less desirable jobs. And I think that many college graduates, for example, the people who have graduated from college recently are aware of this. I mean, you've heard lots of stories of people graduating from college and they're ending up working at Starbucks, right?
Right.
So there aren't huge numbers of these good, solid jobs that really give you a foothold into a career that's going to give you a solid middle-class job. Those jobs are getting harder to come by. And part of the reason, I think, is that all of this technology is beginning to have an impact on automating a more of that entry-level work. Because, you know, entry-level jobs, the kind of job that a new college grad would take, they tend to be more routine and predictable, right? I mean, it's sort of the nature of an entry-level job. They give you something that, you know, is fairly predictable and routine so that you can sort of learn the ropes, right? And then gradually move on to something more elaborate. But a lot of those jobs are being impacted. One good example is journalism, where you're seeing already algorithms that can write news stories. And obviously, it's starting out with more routine, predictable types of things like financial reporting and sports reporting. But I mean, algorithms are increasingly taking over that work.
Right. And it's nothing against the companies that are using this automation and these algorithms to their advantage. It doesn't mean that they're bad. It just means that this is where technology has led us. And now we have to talk about how to deal with the aftershocks.
And this is manifesting initially, you know, first in the digital space, right? These are companies that operate in digital markets and therefore, you know, no, you don't have to hire someone to deliver a tweet, right? Or a Facebook feed. I mean, that all happens digitally by machines, and therefore it's inherently less labor intensive. And we see that initially in the information technology space, companies like Google and Facebook and so forth. But the point I'm making is that in the future, that same kind of structure is going to roll out to more and more of the economy. So that eventually, even a company like Walmart or McDonald's, which is much more focused on the tangible world than the digital world that the Google focuses on, but even they begin to look a lot less labor intensive as well as they begin to rely more on robotics and on artificial intelligence.
You said that being a doctor is a somewhat future-proof career path, but how long do you think we have until it's not safe? I mean, like, it's not that crazy today. I mean, I walk into a doctor's office and they're Googling the symptoms I have, you know, and, you know, yeah. They would be nothing without the software, some of them, you know? So who's to say that soon a doctor will be nothing more than just a person that just operates alongside the AI?
Sure. I mean, that's starting to happen already. I don't think that in the near term, doctors have to, for the most part, be worried about being replaced. I mean, you know, I think they're still going to have a role. They're going to work with the artificial intelligence, but it's definitely going to bring enormous benefits to diagnosing diseases and treating diseases and so forth. Really what it means is that the capabilities of the very best doctors are going to become available to everyone because, you know, we're going to build artificial intelligence that learns from what the very best doctors know. And then in effect, we're going to roll that out to everyone. But so that, you know, you have a doctor who works in conjunction with artificial intelligence, maybe to, you know, do a much better job than would be otherwise possible. Having said that, there are certain kinds of doctors that probably are going to be susceptible to full automation. And one really good example would be a radiologist, right? That's a doctor that specializes specifically on looking at medical images, mammograms and x-rays and things like that. And we're already seeing computers that can outperform radiologists in terms of reading medical images. So I think at some point in the future, those kinds of doctors will quite possibly be automated away and they'll have to, you know, retrain and go into another field or something. But I don't think doctors in general are going to disappear anytime soon. But definitely all of this technology is going to bring tremendous benefits in the field of healthcare and medicine, both in terms of better outcomes and hopefully in terms of making things more efficient and helping to, you know, address the issue of healthcare being such a burden on our society in terms of the expense.
I wonder who is responsible for, you know, if you've in a system where a doctor is working alongside artificial intelligence to diagnose a patient, is the educational process to becoming a doctor still the same, or is it, I wonder what that looks like?
Well, I think doctors are...
They get their degree from Google?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that for the foreseeable future, they're going to go to medical school, and I think medical schools will shift to incorporate these technologies. You know, in the long run, there may be opportunities for people who are not necessarily full-fledged doctors to step into some of these roles. I mean, that's one of the things that I think could be a potential, at least partial solution to the fact that, you know, our healthcare costs are just out of control. I mean, I can imagine when artificial intelligence gets so good that maybe someone that just has an undergraduate degree or a master's degree can be the person that works with the patient and then interfaces with the artificial intelligence and can do some basic routine things. I mean, again, that's not saying that we're going to eliminate doctors completely, but you could have people like that stepping into more routine roles where they're dealing with, you know, with the basics of looking after patients, you know, in cases where maybe someone with a full-fledged medical degree isn't really required. And that might help us to address some of the issues that we're going to face in the coming decades. In particular, we've got an aging population, you know, a lot more older people. This is definitely a trend that we see in many countries, and it's going to put a big burden on our society because we need people to care for these older people, and they're going to have more and more health concerns. That means more doctors, more nurses, more health aides, and there's an enormous opportunity there, both in terms of you know, artificial intelligence, medical diagnosis, and in terms of robots that can help with looking after elderly people. That in many cases is still a tall order. It's a tough challenge, but it's one of the biggest areas of opportunity, I think, in robotics and artificial intelligence.
I can remember being a kid and seeing on my parents' bookshelf, you know, an entire two rows full of encyclopedias and, you know, opening them up whenever I wanted to look at something the way we now use Wikipedia. And what is your perspective on how accessible knowledge has become? Information and is so cheap these days. Do you think that's a good thing?
Sure, it's a good thing as long as, you know, the accessibility of the information is, I think, a universal positive. What is more distressing to me is the way it's evolved in terms of especially the social media platforms that people use, where everything has become so balkanized that the information that people are presented with often just matches their own biases and views, and they're not really, you know, exposed to all the information that's out there. I mean, you know, my vision for the internet is really what it was around the year 2000, maybe, when it was, we had Google and we had this web and you could go and discover anything. And that's kind of the way that I sort of think of it. But now it's all, you know, I'll tell you honestly that I'm not on Facebook. I don't use Facebook. And people that do use it spend an enormous amount of time there and get almost all their news and information through Facebook. And therefore, it's sort of filtered through the views of their friends or whatever, the people that they normally associate with. And so they tend to get just a reinforcement of their views. And I think that's really quite dystopian. And that's something that I really don't want to participate in. That's, I think, one of the most disturbing aspects of the way the internet has evolved. But of course, that's not about access to information. It's about the information that's presented to people.
You know, I really believe that. And that's why I think it's so important to search points and counterpoints when you're reading anything, because especially online, because it's so skewed and filtered by algorithms and all kinds of stuff you don't see before it winds up in your feed. And, you know, I don't believe in crazy radical answers to debates. I think usually the answer is somewhere in the middle, because common sense should unify us. You know, that's why uncensored conversation is so important, and it's being threatened all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the best advice is to do your own research and rely more heavily on trusted sources. You know, the New York Times more than some totally unknown blog, perhaps. But you know, in general, I think the biggest problem is that people don't even do that research at all. They just rely on what's in their newsfeed and don't really bother to sort of give that any further thought at all about whether that came from or whether or not it's reliable.
Should it be so scary that these computers are so much faster at thinking and arriving at accurate answers than humans are? Like, they did that study a few years ago that said the human brain, in terms of processor speeds, like if it were a computer, would be rated at like less than 100 hertz, which is like embarrassingly slow, like slower than a calculator. Like, just there's no comparison. And, you know, on one hand, you could say, well, computers have really helped us. You know, they really make life a lot better. But on the flip side, it's like thinking is what makes us human. So at what point do computers keep us from doing the thing we do best? And is that a problem?
Yeah, I mean, that's a concern that we're gradually becoming more reliant on these technologies. I mean, it's true that, you know, what algorithms and data can produce are many times going to outperform human judgment. And that's, in a sense, not a bad thing. And we should leverage that. We should, make sure we take advantage of that and use it in positive ways. I mean, many people are concerned that all of this can lead to a loss of skill or a loss of human capability, right, as we rely more and more on technology. And that is a genuine concern that I think we have to keep in mind. I mean, a classic example would be GPS, right? I mean, I can remember when I was younger going to Europe and renting a car and having a paper map and figuring it out, even in countries where I didn't know the language. And now I don't know how I did that. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, being in another country, especially and not having, you know, Google Maps to tell me to turn left and turn right. So that to some extent, even, you know, that's an example of a lost skill. Maybe I could get it back if everything went down again. But so that's something to worry a bit about. Now, you hear, you know, classic examples of this happen in aviation, right, where you've seen pilots make mistakes that probably would not have been made by an automated system. And, you know, the reality is that they're getting less practice flying the planes. I mean, there was just an incident, you know, right at the airport I use most frequently in San Francisco. There was almost a total disaster because a jet almost landed on a taxiway where there were a bunch of other huge planes, you know, loaded up with fuel there. And you know, that's something that you worry about, right? And one solution to that is
that was an automated flight or a human flight?
It was a human flight, and apparently they weren't using the automation. If they had been, it wouldn't have happened.
Wow.
But one of the reasons may be that generally pilots rely a lot more on automation, and so they're getting less skilled, or, you know, they're using their skills less and less. So,
but it is still human knowledge that this artificial intelligence is operating on. It's not like it just like came up with all this stuff itself. But that's what makes it so powerful, is it's the entirety of human knowledge in a data bank. And, you know, this is the very first time ever that we've not only have this information together, but we can put it into devices that serve us better. And that's scary, but it's also really cool.
But there is going to be an impact from that. As all of that advances and scales, a lot of average routine jobs are going to disappear. So what do we do about that? And you can imagine a very utopian outcome where, hey, we have all this great technology that gives us all these super things that we've never seen before. And at the same time, people have to work less. So nobody has to do a job they hate, a job that's really boring, a dangerous job. You know, people don't really want to do these jobs anyway. Anyone doing that kind of job, they're doing it because they need the money, right? So if those kinds of jobs disappear, that's not a terrible thing in and of itself. What we have to do is make sure that the people that no longer have access to those jobs still have an income so that they can survive economically. If we solve that problem, you imagine a pretty optimistic utopian future, right? Where people have more time to do stuff they really enjoy, more time for their families, more time for leisure or travel or school or the arts.
Maybe I can make my living as an ice cream critic.
Yeah, well, doing something that you genuinely enjoy, right? So that's not bad. I mean, it's not a bad thing. There are challenges associated with that because our jobs right now, I mean, it's not just about money. They give you something to do. They give you something that gives you a certain status. They provide a social interaction with people in many cases. They provide you a sense of fulfillment. Those are all important things. And our challenge is going to be to figure out a way to make sure people have all that stuff that they need, an income, a sense of accomplishment and of doing something important, a sense of having a place in society, interaction with other people and a social environment and so forth. You know, people still need all those things, but maybe they're not in the future going to get that from a job. So we've got to work that out. And I personally think that one way to do that is to have a basic income and maybe incorporate incentives into that in certain ways. So maybe if you go out and you work in the community and do positive things, help other people, maybe you should get a slightly higher basic income. Or if you stay in school and educate yourself, you should get a slightly higher income. So there are ways to kind of refine this idea of giving everyone a minimal guaranteed income so that it works better and it maybe produces a more productive society. And the other thing is, I think if you give people a basic safety net, then they will take more risks, right? I mean, this is something that has been observed in lots of areas, like children's playgrounds, for example. If you go to a kid's playground now, and I mean, you're young, so maybe it's been this way your whole life, but you see the spongy floor and everything is like plastic. I mean, when I was a kid, okay, playgrounds weren't like that. There were like these big metal things, you know, with tall slides.
Spikes everywhere.
Well, maybe not spikes, but there was, you know, the floor was gravel, okay? So if you fell, you know, you're going to get hurt, right? Now things are quite different, but, you know, the research shows that even though playgrounds have been safer, kids still break their arms at the same rate as they did back in the old days.
Stupid kids. I'm kidding.
And the reason, of course, is that the kids take more risk. I mean, they look and they say, wow, this is really soft, spongy floor. If I fall on it, I'm not going to hurt myself, so I'll do something else. I'll jump in a way I'm not supposed to, or I'll climb on the outside of the thing in the way that the designers didn't intend and take more risks. And so they still end up getting hurt. So the idea is if you give people that additional safety net, they'll take more risk. And I think that that is true also in the economic arena. So if you gave everybody a basic income and they knew that no matter what, they're going to have at least this minimal income, then they would take more economic risk, right? They might be willing to quit a job that is really boring, or they might be more willing to quit a job and start their own business, you know, and take a risk in that way because they know that, you know, they're protected at least to a minimal level. And so a basic income is actually an idea that could, I think, result in a more dynamic entrepreneurial economy. So it could be a great thing in many ways. So again, I think it's really an important idea for the future. Getting to that is a staggering political challenge, especially in the United States. You know, I often go and I have speaking engagements in Scandinavia, Sweden and Norway and Denmark, countries like that. And even in those countries, I mean, they're not ready for it yet. And of course, they have a much more progressive view of the role of government and the importance of having a social safety net than people in the United States do. But even there, it's a big shift in terms of their basic values. So it's not going to be easy getting to a guaranteed income, but I do think it's almost inevitable that that's what's going to have to happen as all of this unfolds.
A lot of times when you hear America compared to the governments of other countries and how much more progressive the other countries are, you hear arguments like, well, America is a huge place. We have way more people than like Denmark. So we could never operate like Denmark operates. You know, what do you think about that?
Well, it's definitely true that, you know, our country is bigger and it's also more diverse. Now, if you look at those countries, and one of the harsh realities here that, you know, people don't like to talk about is that if you have a homogenous society racially and so forth, it's a lot easier to have a strong social safety net. And if you look at those countries in Scandinavia that have those really great safety nets, they were basically put in place, you know, after World War II when it was basically all white people there, right? So that's part of it. We have a much bigger economy, much more diversity, more strife between groups and so forth. So it's going to be harder here. That doesn't mean it won't happen. I think that it's inevitable that it ultimately will have to happen. And I think that one of the really important things we have to do is begin to think universally. You know, we have to think in terms of what's good for everyone. And everyone has to understand that, you know, we have to get away from this idea that programs are for certain groups of people or, and so forth, because that's not going to be true. In the future, as, you know, work becomes less safe, virtually anyone is going to have to rely on these programs. These are going to be universal programs for everyone that everyone at some point in their life might need to rely on. And I think that we really need to come around to that understanding so that we can build an adequate social safety net for everyone. And we need to get everyone to buy into it. And that's why it's really unfortunate that a lot of our language is so divisive now in the United States.
Yeah, it's a huge problem.
You know, the way the world works now is that jobs are the main mechanism that distributes income to consumers so they can buy stuff. If jobs erode or they go away or they become less effective at doing that, we have to fix that somehow. And I think that a universal basic income is one really good way to do that.
Could you talk a little bit about comparative advantage?
Well, the idea of comparative advantage says essentially that every person or every country has got something that they are best at in a relative sense. Okay, now, that doesn't mean that you're absolutely better at someone else, but you, at least relative to that person, you're better at something, and therefore you should always be able to make an income. A classic example is you put two people on an island, okay? And so they're, imagine a plane crashes and these two people are stuck on this island by themselves. And one guy is better at everything. He's better at picking coconuts. He's better at catching fish. You know, he's better at building houses. He's better at everything, okay? Now this other guy is worse at everything. So does that mean that the guy that's worse at everything should do nothing? What exactly does it mean in order to make things most efficient? And the answer that an economist would tell you is that the guy that is worse at everything should focus on the thing that he is least bad at. So if the better guy is 10 times better at climbing trees and getting coconuts, but he's only twice as good at catching fish, then the less good guy should really focus all his efforts on catching fish, so that the guy that is better at everything is freed up to spend more of his time climbing trees and getting coconuts. And that's sort of the theory that economists have come up with to explain why, you know, it always makes sense for countries to trade, and that even countries that are disadvantaged in every way will have a place in the global economy. They'll still find something that they can do to trade. And it should also explain why even people who are generally less capable at everything should be able to find some kind of job to do something. And many people point to this as sort of a scenario as why technology can't ultimately displace everyone, that everyone will still have a job. And it's a complicated explanation, and you kind of have to read the book, but I explain in the book why, you know, artificial intelligence and technology might kind of shake that up and transform that. And the reason is that computers don't face the same kind of opportunity cost that people do. You know, they can do more than one thing at once. They can do things simultaneously, right? Whereas in the example of the two guys on the island, if the guy that's better than everything is catching fish, then he can at the same time be climbing trees and getting coconuts. And therefore, it makes sense for him to have the other guy catch the fish. But if we have artificial intelligence that scales across everything and software that can be replicated, that can do things in a cost-free manner, then, you know, you can imagine a future where technology can really sort of scale across everything. So that's kind of a cumbersome explanation of it. But if you read the book, it's explained more. But comparative advantage is still a very important concept in economics. But the whole point is that it may not apply in exactly the same way when we're talking about robots and artificial intelligence.
Well, thanks so much for coming on today, Martin. It's such a pleasure talking to you and hearing your thoughts. Be sure to check out Martin's book, Rise of the Robots. And what have you been up to since the release of your book?
Well, I'm really focused on this issue. I go around giving a lot of speaking engagements on it. I watch the technology closely. Since the book has been published, I mean, there have been a lot of things that have happened that I think have really led me to believe that this is really happening. I mean, maybe what the most dramatic was Google's DeepMind project that built a system called AlphaGo that won at the ancient Asian game of Go, which is, you know, it's an incredibly sophisticated game, much more sophisticated than chess. And computer scientists thought that this wouldn't happen for at least another 10 years. But Google was able to build a system that taught itself to play this game and then became superhuman at it. It could now beat the very best players in the world. And a lot of people have really been quite, that's really been something that's kind of woken them up. The other thing that's happening is dramatic progress in self-driving cars and self-driving trucks. So, I mean, I see a lot of evidence that this is really happening. And I do think that this is going to be one of the biggest challenges we face in the coming decade. You know, how do we adapt to this? What do we do about this? And so I think it's great that people like you are thinking about this and, you know, incorporating it into your podcast, because I really think it's important that people, and especially younger people, and I assume that's who probably is going to listen to this, you really need to start thinking about this.
They're actually all old and hard of hearing, so you don't want to speak up.
Okay. But this is going to have an incredible impact on your future and on your life. I mean, you know, during the primes of your lives, this is going to unfold. It's going to be a big deal. So, you know, start waking up and thinking about it and start thinking about what we should do about this, because it's going to be a very, very big deal.
What an exciting time we get to live in when we're deciding how these things will play out in our day-to-day lives. Martin, I really appreciate you giving us your time to come on the podcast and share your ideas. Is there going to be another book anytime soon?
Not soon. I mean, I wrote an earlier book called The Lights in the Tunnel. You might want to, you know, anyone that's interested in this might want to check that out too, because that's in some ways a more futuristic book that actually thinks further into the future and really struggles with what should we do about this. So I'd encourage everyone to take a look at both those books. But right now I'm really focused on bringing as much attention to this issue as I can, because I do think that that's just incredibly important.
It is incredibly important, and hats off to you for taking the initiative and spreading awareness about these issues. And, I think a lot of good is going to come out of this work that you're doing. So,
okay. Thanks a lot for having me.
Take care, Martin. Well, we covered a lot of ground today. That was kind of a lot to take in, but I just want to remind people that this is not a place where you ever need to worry about being convinced of something. The goal of this podcast is to learn and explore ideas, and Martin's on the forefront of what's happening in artificial intelligence, so I just think it's smart to just hear his thoughts. And in light of all the algorithm talk, I do believe it's so important that we have a place for unfiltered, uncensored conversation, because these algorithms, that's essentially what they do. They filter things out that they don't want, that the people who own them don't want. And it can be a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing. Just like anything good, it can go bad. So talking about it is important. I want to hear what you think about this conversation. Drop me a line in the comments section or shoot me an email if it's long. hello@spellboundshow.com. And, you know, we might feature some questions here from time to time. So be sure to check back in next week. I will be talking to Dr. Richard Elliott Friedman, author of Who Wrote the Bible, The Bible with Sources Revealed, and The Exodus. He's one of the world's leading experts on the Old Testament. So if that sounds interesting, check back in. Be sure to hit that subscribe button so your phone stays up to date with every episode. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And I will see you guys next week.